Hello and welcome to the 1840 podcast, where each month we explore a different topic balancing modern sensibilities with traditional sensitivities to give you new approaches to timeless Jewish ideas. I'm your host, David Beshefkin, and this month we're exploring Jewish peoplehood. The concept of Jewish peoplehood, to me, has always kind of been full of contradiction. I don't know about you, but I'm kind of the kind of person I have a lot of different connections, whether with family or socially or professionally, that they don't always like cohere. Meaning if all the people were kind of to descend into one room, I would need like almost a cheat sheet of sorts, like a little piece of paper to like say like, you know, who gets along with who and who understands, you know, one another. And I feel like a lot of times when we talk about Jewish peoplehood in concept, it's a lot easier than when you really start drilling down and connecting to Jews. It reminds me in many ways of, I don't know what to call it, a joke or an idea, but I thought it was absolutely brilliant. It kind of circulated in like WhatsApp groups or, you know, in texts and online, social media. This wonderful idea, quote, from Rav Y.Y. Jacobson, who's such a brilliant speaker and scholar, and he was talking about the difference between the way anti-Semites and Jews relate to the Jewish people. And he said anti-Semites, when it comes to the way they, you know, conceptualize Jews, you know, they hate Jews, I hate the Jewish people, they're the worst, I can't deal with them. And then, you know, if you go up to them and say, well, what about your dentist? They say, ah, he's a good guy. He's not like the rest of them. And what about your accountant? Ah, he's okay. He's also good. He's an exception. What about your, you know, the neighbor down the street? Okay, they're also good. So, like, conceptually, they hate the Jews. But when you start to drill down, you know, they're like, okay, there are many who I get along with. Conversely, when you talk to Jews, Jews love talking about the Jewish people. We love the Jewish people. It's so easy to love the Jewish people. Klal Yisrael, you know, we love talking about that. But then you ask them about their accountant, their dentist, the guy who sits next to them at shul. Ah, I hate that guy. I can't stand that guy. This woman, she's awful. I don't like the way she, you know. When you start drilling down and talking about specifics, a lot of the love starts to break down, where it's almost much easier for us to conceptually connect to the notion of Klal Yisrael, and it's much more difficult to drill down and really like look at someone as a Jew and connect with them, because I think a lot of the ambiguity is like, if I don't know them from my neighborhood and I don't know them from my school or shul, then like, what do I have in common with them? And, like, that's a scary thing to me that, like, I think the notion of, like, what we have in common, that concept of Klal Yisrael, it sometimes, like, deteriorates when you sit across from another Jew. And, you know, let's say the Jewish geography doesn't yield any great connections and you didn't, you know, you weren't in the same place when you were davening on Rosh Hashanah 8 years ago. Oh, I was also in that shul and that yeshiva and that seminary. Oh, that... Let's say you don't have that connection. So how do you connect to that larger body of the Jewish people, so to speak? And that's why I'm so excited about this topic and who we're speaking with this month, because I really think we assembled an incredible array, an incredibly diverse array of people who are grappling, leading, developing this notion of what it means to connect to the entirety of the Jewish people. And I find that really refreshing and interesting to see how different people conceptualize that and navigate that, particularly with some in interviews who conceptualize that after having disappointment with the Jewish people, after going through some crisis of sorts and figuring out how to put the pieces together of your Jewish identity and what puzzle piece you play in the larger Jewish community. Our first guest today is really an absolute honor. It's a kavod. There's no other way to put it. And that is with Rav Aaron Lopiansky, who is a Rosh Yeshiva and a leader of the Yeshiva world community, both in the United States and in Israel. And I want to talk a little bit about why I thought specifically to speak with him about the topic of Jewish peoplehood, because it wasn't, you know, if you those who know him and those who have read his writings, it's not really the central topic. He's a Talmud Chacham of the first order, and his scholarship surrounds Torah. It's not really a person who's, you know, coming out and talking about peoplehood and identity in that sense. But I absolutely, and this was in the works for a long time, had him in mind. I think the first reason why I thought about specifically not just this Rosh Hashiva, but having a Rosh Hashiva, is because I think a lot of times people mischaracterize the value and the importance of the yeshiva community. I think we've all been in rooms where somebody is criticizing some component of the Jewish community, and maybe it was us. I've been in rooms where every aspect of the Jewish community has been criticized. I've been in rooms where people are criticizing Orthodox Jews. I've been in rooms where people are criticizing non-Orthodox Jews. I've been in rooms where people are, you know, criticizing unaffiliated Jews. And I think, you know, every community has its criticism. But, you know, there's always something that has bothered me about, and maybe this is just on like that little microverse of Twitter, almost like a misunderstanding or mischaracterization about the yeshiva world. And that is, like, we use these terms like ultra-Orthodox and very, like, insular, and it paints them as like, an other, as, like, this community that's, like, walled out and is not contributing to the larger body of the Jewish people. And I think that is so absolutely far from the truth. And believe it or not, it's a little wild to say, I was at a conversation like this at some retreat, conference, I forgot what it was, and most of the people there were unaffiliated, and to, you know, to no fault of their own. I mean, it's the same way that affiliated people in many ways, you know, mischaracterize and criticize people who they don't know on a personal level. I think it certainly goes both ways. But in this situation, I was talking, you know, it was a group of, you know, Jewish communal people or whatever it was, and they were being fairly critical of the yeshiva community. And somebody got up who had left the Hasidic world, was no longer Hasidish, and he actually said he had an amazing thought experiment. I'll tell you who it was. It was Shulam Dean. He was sitting in that circle, and he said, could you imagine for a moment what the world would look like without a yeshiva community? Meaning, how would that change, you know, the Jewish music that you listen to, the Jewish books that you find? Where exactly would you buy your mezuzahs, your Sifrei Torah, tefillin, so many of the Jewish objects? Meaning, who's creating all this? Kosher meat. So much of this seems, or it's characterized as, coming from this insular community that, you know, is not interacting, but people don't appreciate, you know, that thought experiment of, like, imagine a world without it. And I remember I was once talking to a class, students of mine, and the analogy that I used, and pardon for use the a movie analogy to describe this, but it's a very famous line of dialogue, and it's from the movie A Few Good Men, in that famous courtroom scene where Tom Cruise's character is cross-examining Colonel Jessup, who's played by Jack Nicholson. And they're interrogating him because they are angry, they're upset at kind of his tactics and things that were going on his base camp. And Colonel Jessup's response, I've always found an incredibly profound rumination of sorts about the accusation of insularity. And this is his response.
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide, and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a d- what you think you are entitled to.
I'm God forbid. I mean, in the movie, he's kind of the villain, but I still think it's a very powerful quote, and I think it's powerful because what the yeshiva world is protecting is very often lost by those who are beneficiaries of those protections, who are kind of cultivating this reservoir of Yiddishkeit, of rich Torah culture, and spreading it throughout the world. And they're not always given that credit. And that's why I wanted to almost begin at like almost the center of sorts of people who are guarding the proverbial walls of Jewish life and Jewish culture and Jewish ritual and all of those things, who face a lot of criticism. You know, we've all been in the room. You know, my father always says, whenever somebody calls it the Haredim, my father's a doctor, they say it with the same tone as people talk about the measles or the mumps, as if it's like this, like infection, God forbid. And I've certainly been in rooms, and I don't know anybody who hasn't, who segments of the Jewish community have been criticized, and I think that the Haredi community very often is subject to that unfair criticism without an appreciation of what their protection, and in many ways I think they are protecting and perpetuating something, and we in many ways, whether you're a part of that community or beneficiaries, we all in a way are benefiting from that. And that's why it's such a pleasure to talk to what I think is one of the great thought leaders of that community, of the Torah community, of the yeshiva community, and that is Rav Aaron Lopiansky. But that's not the only reason. That's why I wanted specifically somebody who's within that community. There are really two other reasons why I specifically reached out and really hounded him. I felt bad. He was on vacation in Eretz Yisrael at the time, in Israel. So if the Wi-Fi connection and the audio is a little weak, you will forgive me. But he made a real effort to be a part of that, and it really means a great deal to me. The second reason why I chose specifically Rav Lopiansky, aside from it's just an absolute joy to speak with him, is he wrote an article really at the height of Corona that many people read, and was what I think I termed, I don't want to call it radical because it sounds like subversive. It wasn't subversive, but it was really pushing the way the Jewish community thinks about redemption and Mashiach. And the article, which was published in Mishpacha magazine, was "Sometimes Mashiach is Not the Solution." And he challenged the Jewish community to kind of like remind them that just because things are bad is not, that's not what's motivating our yearning for redemption. And in the article, which I encourage everybody to read and we have linked on the site, he really makes two points that I found incredibly, incredibly powerful. I mean, the whole article is absolutely worth reading, and in my mind is a rumination on what Jewish peoplehood is all about. But there are two lines that I think are really, really incredible. One of them is where he talks about how, you know, the basic premise of it is that the time and place, and this is kind of the subheader, the time and place to yearn for redemption is especially when we're at our best. It's not because things are going bad, because when things are going bad, you want redemption because you're upset with your paycheck, you don't like how your family is responding to you. And those are all great reasons, but there's something much larger at stake. There's something much more like that national idea of Jewish peoplehood that we are trying to realize when we think about redemption and Mashiach. And this is what he writes. He says, "We need to teach our children history, and that history needs to include much more than dry names and dates and stories of Gedolim. They need to have an accurate understanding of the experiences of the Jewish communities of each generation, the daily life, the hardship, the challenges, the successes, and the wounds. The Pusuk, the Torah, implores us to contemplate the years of each generation. And I just thought that was just a wow suggestion, that part of almost our national yearning for redemption is founded and requires an appreciation of Jewish history, of what we've been through. And it's not enough to say, hey, I had a bad day at work. And certainly the coronavirus, I'm, God forbid, not minimizing the devastation, the tragedy of that. But what he is saying is that inconvenience, difficulty, even tragedy should not be the sole motivator. It really needs to come from a much more holistic appreciation of the Jewish people, and not just the Jewish people of this generation in 2020, but the Jewish people throughout times. And then he pushes back, and this is really why, you know, some of the reason why he's so remarkable, in that this is a person who could give a very high Talmud Gemara shiur to, you know, 100 students or 50 students, but, he does that as well. But in addition to that, he really provides, it's not reinforcement. He pushes the Torah community to think about these fundamental values in different ways. He's not confirming the way that they think about it. He's asking people to think about it differently. And this is what he writes in that very same article. We tend to think about ourselves, in quotes, the Torah observant community, he's talking to the readership of Mishpacha magazine, which is certainly, you know, that yeshiva Orthodox community. We tend to think about ourselves, the Torah observant community, as Klal Yisrael, and the others as a reservoir of potential additions. It's the other way around, he writes. Klal Yisrael is the sum total of all of us, and we are missing 90% of ourself. And I thought that this was just a very powerful feedback and pushback on what comes to mind when we think about Klal Yisrael. You know, most people say, I know, Klal Yisrael, it's not just the great rabbis, it's not just the Gedolim, it's also, you know, the Froom bus driver who I know, it's also the street sweeper in the old Hasidic stories. But he's pushing even further, and he's saying, no. You don't realize that part of that body includes the people who we rightfully, in many ways, protest, the people who have nothing to do with anything going on, totally unaffiliated in every which ways, and the people who affiliate in ways that we find extraordinarily contradictory in the Torah community. And learning how to navigate all of those appendages, all of those body parts of that larger body of the Jewish people is part of the exercise of redemption. And to just look at redemption as solely, you know, your, you know, 10 blocks and the alumni of your yeshiva or seminary, it's not enough. And we need to be broader and bigger people than just that, which is why I found it so remarkable. And there's one final point, and it kind of speaks to a little bit of the tone of the interview. Rav Lopiansky speaks to all of the Jewish people, but his day-to-day role as Rosh Hashiva is to a men's yeshiva in Greater Washington, in Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm sorry. And he wrote an amazing book, and a lot of what we spoke about is kind of geared towards that audience, because he has a book called Ben Torah for Life, which, you know, if you read the book on a cursory level, it's like, you know, somebody who's kind of looking at it from the outside, I would understand why they would kind of say, you know, same old, you know, you got to work, you got to learn, you got to, you know, Torah and balance everything. I read this book very closely, and it is founded on again, I don't want to use the word radical, but he really pushes people to think differently about the narrative, not only of the Jewish people, but of their individual lives. The book is founded on a premise that just like the Jewish people have 12 tribes, and the body of Klal Yisrael, Knesset Yisrael, has these 12 Shevatim, these 12 tribes, that also exists inside of every individual within the Jewish people, meaning every individual has 12 tribes inside of them, which I thought was a fascinating idea. And the book is really about cultivating and developing the notion of what it means inside of you to be a part of that Shevet Levi, the tribe, you know, the tribe of Levi, who dedicated their life exclusively to divine service, to Torah study, and to davening, and to all of those things. And what he's trying to allow people to explore is that shave at Levi, even if it's not the full manifestation of who you are and how you live your life every day, there is that shave at, so to speak, inside of you, and you need to cultivate it and find the time for it. You can't just coast the rest of your life on those years that you may have had being immersed in a shave at Levi lifestyle. You need to cultivate and develop that inner shave at Levi that exists throughout your life. And this kind of interested me in particular. For those listeners who know me in other circles, know that I wrote a book called Synagogue, about sin and failure in Jewish life. And I almost thought about my own book as like developing that conception, not of the Shave at Levi, but almost of the Shave at Dun, which in, you know, theology and ideas is kind of the lowliest of tribes. They were, you know, kicked out of the Anane HaKavod, the divine clouds. And the book is, my book is kind of using his terminology and lens, is kind of helping people navigate that inner Shave at Dun, the lowliest of tribes that exists also within each of us. So again, there's no package deal buying our two books, and far be it from me to compare my work to the Rosh Hashivas, to Rev Lopiansky's. But I do think there is a parallel there in our respective books, and in some ways in our respective work. And that's why I was not surprised, but so appreciative that he was gracious enough to say yes. I'll kind of leave with one idea before we introduce the podcast. And that is, Rev Lopiansky, in a lot of it is in Hebrew, has amazing eulogies, hespedim, for Jewish leaders. And there is a hesped, a eulogy that he wrote for his teacher, Rev Nachum Persavitz, who was his Rebbe in the Mir, that has an introduction that I've used a lot in my own speeches, whether it's in Ofros or writings, and I've always just found it absolutely brilliant. And I think it's really the only way to characterize not only Rav Nachum Persavitz, but his student, Rav Lopiansky himself. And in there he kind of compares two Talmudic works. One is the work of the Maharsha, which is a Talmudic commentary, and the other is the work of the Chidushei Harim, the first Rebbe of Ger. And he compares that when you learn Maharsha, which is a very intricate, like you really have to know the detailed logical progression of the Gemara to appreciate it, and when you learn a Maharsha, you just have to know all the details. You really have to know them. As opposed to when you learn a Chidushei Harim, he has these kind of like almost clever, brilliant insights that even if you don't know every line and the back and forth of every detail on that page of Talmud and the Gemara, you could still kind of like smile and say, wow, that was a really brilliant question. And in this eulogy, Rev Lopiansky says, the same as with people. There are some people who you meet who are like Maharshas. Like, you don't really appreciate them the first time you meet them, but once you get to know them, you know, that's always how I introduce friends of mine, because I'm nervous that people aren't going to appreciate them or like them. Like, once you get to know them, they're great. You know, I promise you. It's like me defending, you know, in the back end WhatsApp, you know, two mutual friends who I know don't get along with each other. I'm like, once you get to know them, they're great. You know, the Maharshas, once you get through the Gemara and know all the details, I promise you, you'll love them. It's wonderful. As opposed to, there are other friends who are like Chidushei Harim. There are personalities, there are people who the moment you meet them, you're like, wow, this person is absolutely wonderful. This is somebody who I know I'm going to love, who I know I'm going to have a friendship with. And Rev Lopiansky wrote this about his Rebbe, and dare I use this analogy to describe Rev Lopiansky himself. He has the characteristics of somebody who the more that you read about them, the more that you immerse yourself in their writings, the more you appreciate them. But you don't just have to do that. Rev Lopiansky has a welcomeness. There is a doorway, so to speak, into the world that he represents, the ideas that he so masterfully articulates, that are almost also like the Chidushei Harim. And you read one article and one book, and he has so many, and we have links to all of them online, that you immediately appreciate them. And hopefully these two characteristics of the Maharsha and the Chidushei Harim, you know, the book that you have to toil to understand, and the book that the moment you open up the first page, you're already smiling, which I think Rev Lopiansky embodies both. Hopefully through our conversation, you'll learn to take those two, you know, models, so to speak, and learn to love and appreciate the full body of the Jewish people.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It really means a lot.
I want to tell you, use your discretion. If you feel that this is, that, you know, the, whatever comes out is not what you want to present, if you feel it's overshot, undershot, whatever it is, don't hesitate. It's, you use your discretion. You know the audience.
I want to begin by talking a little bit about your upbringing and specifically the type of Jewish home that you were raised in.
So I think both my home and my milieu of upraising is today kind of unusual. My parents were both Holocaust survivors. I grew up with Yiddish as my first language. I didn't speak English till second grade. I grew up in Lower East Side, which is a museum piece. It was a wonderful place and a tragic place. It had tens and tens of thousands of Jews. It was the tail end of the people who had settled as immigrants, their children perhaps. Their Yiddishkeit was positive, traditional, but something happened. Either you went to yeshiva and your Yiddishkeit became solidified, you understood what you're doing, why you're doing, you became enthusiastic and positive about it, or you went off and it just evaporated. So that's my background. So I went to RJJ, which was a school that today would include, it would be something like from the left to the right and everything in between. It was sort of a generation that separated into the different factions, yeshivish, Hasidish, and not religious, somewhat religious, traditional. And that's my background.
So it happens to me, my brother-in-law is currently a Sholom Eishiv in RJJ. It preserves a certain type of Yiddishkeit that is quite charming and less common in America now. Eventually, you decided to study in Eretz Yisrael in the Mir, and you studied under the renowned both Reb Chaim Shmulevitz and Reb Nachum Persovitz. Why did you decide to go to Eretz Yisrael that was much less common than what we see now, for sure?
So I'll be very forthright. Somewhere in the middle, I began to get into learning, and I wanted to make my life centered around learning. In those days, there was not a strong ruach for learning at all. Lakewood had 200 people maybe, and it was very, very difficult. There was a lot of pressure. And Eretz Yisrael was a place where people would sit and learn. And Reb Nachum and Reb Chaim were towering figures. And it was like the dream was like kind of, I don't want to use the word like Harvard, but that was the idea, Reb Nachum and Reb Chaim. So it was a combination of wanting to have a stress-free environment vis-a-vis the learning and having the sense of greatness of Reb Chaim and Reb Nachum.
What's always fascinated me is that you eventually married into one of the most prominent families of Torah, education, and leadership in Israel, the Rav Beinish Finkel, who was the head of the Mir at the time. And for most people, it was the dream setup where you could have, I assume, taught in the Mir or taught in yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. And at some point in your life, you decided to come back to America and teach Torah and begin a yeshiva in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is not Lakewood, for those you know who don't know a map carefully.
Well, we got geography. Those who geography needs a bit of touching.
So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the decision not to stay in Eretz Yisrael and teach Torah there, where the yeshivas were thriving much more, and come back to the United States, and not just come back to the United States, to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Lakewood, but to go to Silver Spring, Maryland, where, again, I was in yeshiva about an hour away in Neir Yisrael. Silver Spring is not known right now as the Ir HaTorah necessarily. It's not known as the citadel of Torah learning. So why did you make that choice?
So first of all, I did live in Eretz Yisrael 25 years. It's 50 years since I came to Eretz Yisrael. And I want to correct something you said. I didn't start the yeshiva. It's not my yeshiva. It was started by Rev. Einam Zechayin Avracha, who was the rav of the town, of the city, and he started a yeshiva high school in the 60s when nobody there was sending to yeshiva high schools. Mr. Snefesh was incredible. So yes, I've been in charge of Yeshiva Gdola, but the schus of founding a Mokum Torah is Rav Einam Israel of Racha. Yibara L'chaim, Rabbi Merkin, came in about 35 years ago, 36 years ago, and he energetically moved the yeshiva tremendously forward with his tremendous capabilities. He was the one who fought tooth and nail and got the funding for Yeshiva Gdola, so I really need to give credit there. But I want to tell you, I was there for a day or two to look at it, and I saw the boys, and I liked it. It reminded me a lot of where I came from, the sincerity, it's people, whether the people were modern Orthodox or whatever name you want to call it, there was genuineness, sincerity, intelligence, openness. It's very, very much, I felt I could connect well. I felt that this is where I was 25 years ago, and I'd like to be a catalyst in people's lives the same way that, you know, people have been a catalyst in my life. And Baruch Hashem, I've never looked back in that decision. And it's you know, 25 years later, seeing the way the town developed in a very Torah way, in a very positive way. And it, you know, really the color of the yarmulke doesn't make a difference. It's a sincerity. It's a commitment to shmiras and mitzvahs in a very positive way. It's learning. And Baruch Hashem. So I guess, I hate to sound corny, but I think it was Hashem had a lot to do with it. So I really feel as satisfied. And Baruch Hashem Yerushalayim, there are 1,000 people can do the job. I could do it much better. This was an opportunity where maybe I could make the difference because I could come down there and be there. It's, you know, Baruch Hashem.
Maybe you could speak a little bit, having lived in Eretz Yisrael and in Marbitz Torah in Eretz Yisrael, taught Torah in Eretz Yisrael, and also in America. Can you speak a little bit about the differences between the Torah community in Israel and the Torah community in America, and what are the challenges facing each?
I guess, going back to the Torah life model, the ability for that to express itself in a Balabatish community as well, where people can also choose not to make Torah their calling and still be part of that world is a big challenge. And what happens is you get a lot of divide. And it doesn't make a difference which way you're passionate. And people are very, very strong-minded about what they think. And therefore, they will be very passionate, and they're going to it's going to be difficult to get along. So in Eretz Yisrael, the being extremely powerfully focused and passionate produced a core of a very, very powerful Torah group. You have Talmud Torah at a tremendous level. On the other hand, that become an entire panorama of a community is a challenge. On getting along with other people in a way that allows for that interaction is a challenge. That's Eretz Yisrael. In America, there is such a, I don't know if the word is respect, but being materially well-to-do is really down deep a mark of success. And it draws people, and it's all-consuming. You can, whatever your persuasion is, if you're into making money and a lot of it, it has a way of dragging you away from core values. And it's a struggle. So you'll have people that are sitting and learning, very dedicated way. You'll have wonderful communities, but the amount that you need to make it between tuition and this and that, and then the possibilities, the potentials, and the draw of making a lot of money has a lot of challenges. So I see the challenges. Each community has its own forte. In America, people have an easier time of moving from yeshiva to out of yeshiva. It's not as strongly defined, as sharply defined. Communities do have a way of getting along much easier with each other. It's all part of the same picture. On the other hand, it's easier to get sucked into 1,001 things, and nominally you might have a black hat, you might have a shrine, might have the kippah sugah, but it's all about nicer, better, you know, and whatever it is. So those, I think, are each place has its own challenges, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts different challenges for different communities.
I want to talk about the novelty, the chiddush of your book, which has changed so many lives, Ben Torah for Life. It's a book about the transition from the yeshiva world, from an institutional religious life into the working world. And you talk about it a little bit in the introduction, but I was wondering if you could speak more about why write this book, and if you were worried at all, because other people have written books like this, maybe, you know, a few decades ago, and were criticized as almost like you're building a doorway outside of the yeshiva that people should leave. So was there concern when you were first developing this book about both balancing the yeshiva values of the book, but also helping that transition? So why did you write it, and were you concerned a little bit about criticism?
So even more worried about criticism is that point. And in a certain sense, my own personal feelings are almost a conundrum. And I want to explain where I'm coming from. I think this is a critical piece to understanding where I'm coming from with the book. Let's first take a mashal. This is when I was learning in school and geography. I don't know if they still teach geography, but in those days, the geography, they explained why a real map of the world is impossible. Because the world is a globe. It's a ball of some sort. When you want to flatten it out, you're going to lose something. So you either have, if I remember correctly, there were three possible maps. You either lost the correct shape, or the size, the relative sizes. That's why Greenland can look like a small thing when it's usually huge, and so on. Or you could have these orange slices where things are fairly accurate, but they're disjunct. And those are the really annoying maps. I don't have to, again, where they have these slices.
I know exactly. I can never read them. I know exactly what you're describing.
They always said this is the most accurate. I couldn't look at it. It looked horrible. It's very unpleasant to the eye. And basically the point is, you know, you cannot take a three-dimensional thing, make it two-dimensional without losing something. And the point I'm trying to make in the book is the dissonance between the years and the shmooze and the minds of the yeshiva to the years afterwards is the same as Shevet Levi to other shvatim. There's a piece in your soul that sits there and says, I remember what it was like sitting on a Thursday night all night trying to get a Teretz Vegas kasha and knowing nothing else makes a difference. That should be like the core, the nuclear reactor of a person's neshama. Then the person has to ask himself, what am I supposed to do now? What are my obligations? I have a family, I have to feed them. I need to do X, Y, or Z. I have capabilities. I have responsibilities. So I can't think of one book that would include it all, except for the Torah. And what you do need is two sets of shmuzen. I feel the Achilles heel. I think the reason why there's a need for a book is boys have plenty of strong, fiery models in the younger years, 17, 18, 19. But when they're 24, 25, and they need to start thinking of life, what am I going to do? What's my role? How do I belong? They're no longer in any framework that has that type of personality. And then there's no real sense of somebody being able to sit down quietly and say, listen, for you, this is, you're making a decision to go this direction, this is what you should do, and so on. So I didn't even realize, I think that was the point where it comes in. It's coming in to say, okay, there's a message that's appropriate at one phase of life, there's a message at second phase, the message at third phase. I once read, I remember as a young boy, and I couldn't understand it. It said that the Alter of Kelum, who was the Baal Musa in his generation, arguably he trained the Mashkichim of the next generation, and he would say Shmuz in the yeshiva, and he also spoke for the Baal Batim in the shul. Bachrim were not allowed to go and to hear any shmooze in the shul. It was strictly prohibited. One Bachar decided, you know, he wanted to hear, he went, and he said afterwards, he really regretted it. He felt that it wasn't the right message for him. So there are times in life, and each time needs to understand what's the appropriate things to do. It's the same way on a person. Let's say a person is a Bachar. So learning 24/7 is a wonderful message if a person can do it. If he gets married, even sitting in Kolo, he needs to begin to understand what it means to spend time with your wife, with your children, maybe doing something for the community. It's a message that needs to come in at a later time in life. I think that's where I was coming from.
In the introduction to the book, you talk a little bit with stronger terminology about the, you use the term yourself, like dissonance, the pain when you leave and when you look back at everything that you invested and you kind of, you don't see the dignity and the dividends from that investment pay off. Is there ever a time where we could be pumping people up almost too much, where they get too excited and then they almost overinvest in a specific path? Or is the right way, and I guess this is a little bit more in the direction you did, pump them up when they're 16, 17, but then you have to ease them out. But the danger, and maybe you could talk about this, is the, how do you talk to somebody when there's the regret, when there's the cynicism? That when that cynicism creeps in and that anger creeps in, what could we explain to people that they don't look at that initial investment in their more passionate teenage, early 20s years and look at it with negativity and almost anger?
There's something that's not in the book because it just wasn't relevant, but I think it's an important point that we need to stress more in yeshivas as follows. We talk about becoming a gadol. So the word sounds like everybody becomes a Reb Chaim Kanievsky of sorts. And that's our image of a gadol. That image, even if you stay in yeshiva, is an image that you at some point you're going to dash your head against the racks, except for the one Reb Chaim Kanievsky. So I don't think that's even a true image to feed people in. A finer version of it and more true, which was the Slabodka model, and it really is the MS. We have to begin to define a big person on personal terms. In other words, to be able to understand that if you're able to control your actions through your ideals and your seichel, you're a big person. If you're able to do things that you know you should do, even though you don't feel like doing them, you've become a bigger person. If you don't feel a need to sort of publicize yourself and you're happy with what you're doing because it's the right thing, even if no one knows about it, Gadlus Adam means being a very big person. So if I am now, I'm just kind of picking age, I'm 30. And no job in the Torah world has opened up for me or is suitable for me. And now I'm going to have to go to law school or get into a business from the bottom. And it's going to take me 3-4 more years. It's a lot of hardship and sacrifice. But I know what I sacrificed for, and I know what I accomplished. I'm a big person. I know mesechtes. I know big things. I've gained control of myself. So at least I know what it's for. It's one thing if my dream was childish and self-centered, of being just having my pictures flash in the papers. I mean, so nobody thinks of that way, but down deep, that's what that is saying. And I should become the household name. So now I'm nobody. So then people, then I'm neither here nor there. But if people were to have a sense that the years they spent in yeshiva made them big people, different people. I want to tell you a story. You asked me about my early years. that really, really made an impression on me. It's a small story, but it's a big story. The first year I was in Eretz Yisrael, I had cousins in Tel Aviv. Reb Dov Lapin's friend of Rachel, very special person, very special person. I came there for Shabbos. In those days, Tel Aviv was a traditional city. No, it was not a frum city, but people were more traditional. There were quite a few from older people living there. Shabbos afternoon, I went for a walk. Shderot Rothschild, and I sat down on a bench, and an older couple came by. They were what you'd call very Balbatish people. They very nice. They stopped. They asked me where I'm from, what I'm doing. I said, I came to Israel, I'm learning yeshiva. And they said, oh, that's so nice. We also have a son, and he's learning in yeshiva. I think it was Marcus Rab, they said. I don't remember. And you should know, we're so proud. He's a real Talmud Chacham. And, you know, whatever. So I reflected something about the semantics that they used. I said, in America, I'd be hard-pressed to find people like that proud of the son of yeshiva. But if I would, they would say he's the best Bachan Lakewood. Nobody would say I'm proud of him because he's a big Talmud Chacham. They would say he's the best, he's the biggest, he's the brightest. They would only be able... And I said to myself, that must be something unique about it, it's strong. It stuck in my mind the scene. I think if we were to give Bachrim an internal goddess, you know, whatever it is that you accomplish, I know these mesechtes, I know these siman shaharos. I've worked on myself, and I'm a different person. And the 10 years I spent learning, it endowed me with a certain godless, personal godless. Then people would understand what they sacrificed for.
In your book, you use an amazing framework about the notion that there are 12 Shvatim, there are 12 tribes, and that's not only with the Jewish people, but that's even inside of you, and kind of fostering the notion that there is a Shevet Levi, the tribe that dedicated itself to Torah learning. You can foster that ember, develop that ember inside of you. There's another theme that's adjacent to that, this notion of, you know, the 12 tribes of the Jewish people. And we're going to come back to the tribes that reside inside of you. But you wrote a remarkable article that, you know, a lot of people were speaking about the notion and idea of Mashiach and redemption. And one of the things that you talk about relates squarely to the theme that we want to discuss, which is about connecting, you know, we talk about big people inside of you, but big people who can encompass all of the Jewish people. More than one time in your writing, you have reminded the yeshiva world of the fact that their association with Klal Yisrael is really through a funhouse mirror of sorts. Because when we close our eyes and think about Klal Yisrael, we think about all the yeshivas. We think about all the people who are learning. And we forget the fact that 90% of the Jewish people they're not connected to this at all. So my first question that I want to understand is, how does the, broadly speaking, communities of Shevet Levi, how do they develop an, dare I say, appreciation, or at least a connection to the other Shvatim, so to speak? How do we foster that? Because we need that insularity, we need these communal norms and the boundaries, but at the same time, we keep on forgetting about the rest of Klal Yisrael.
Yes, I mean, obviously, that's the point I was making. So there are so many opportunities, let's say out-of-town kollelim type of opportunities, seed programs. As important as they are for the communities you go to, I think it's equally important for the people that are in the yeshiva, to look around and to understand. And again, the problem is when you're a 17-year-old boy or 18-year-old boy is when you hear most of the Musa Shmusen. And the other message should be, kids that age want to run all over the place. You can tell them, you know, nail yourself to the chair and learn, and let somebody else worry about Klal Yisrael and so on. And again, that's usually age appropriate. But when somebody gets a little older, encouraging Yungalites to have chavrusas out of that frame, It's one of the things where I think HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up the yeshiva world to be dependent on the world outside financially so that they actually interact, they actually care. The Gemara says it, that the grape should daven for the leaf, because without it, it has no kiyum of its own. It's something which should, those connections should be fostered. It's something for us in yeshiva, since our yeshiva is actually physically located smack in the middle of the Soul Spring community. It also is the open based measure community, and there's a lot of connection. So sometimes it's a little bit disruptive. Obviously, yeshiva would like to have its own suda. On the other hand, it gives boys a certain sense of what's out there. So part of a chinuch process would be at the appropriate times to make those connections. Seed programs are a wonderful opportunity. Out of town kolam are a wonderful opportunity. Many of these programs nominally are for the benefit of the people in the Makariv. I think it's for the benefit of the people sitting in the Beis Medrash. My Rebbe Chaim Shmulevitz was a phenomenal masmid. He could be seen as the quintessential masmid, but he would repeat often the chazal about Rebbe Yare was an amaretz came and told him that it's your fault that I'm not learning Torah. You stole it from me. He said, what do you mean? It says, Torah tzivolon and Moshe Mereshes Kilos Yaakov. It's my Yerusha, and I never got my share. So you probably are holding my share. And he would speak about that. He would talk about that. Even in a yeshiva, encouraging a stronger boy to learn some part of the time with a weaker boy is important. I want to tell you something that the Mir Yeshiva in Europe was considered the yeshiva, the Mir. They spoke about the Mir. It was sort of the yeshiva that fed in from all of the yeshivas, and you know, rightfully considered itself to be the king of yeshivas and so on. And Rabbi Lezudel made it tough to get in, and they had the chash, the chaburis there. He had a very fascinating methodology. In those days, even Bachrim got money from the yeshiva to support their needs. In other words, like Kolol, there was no dormitory or kitchen, so the yeshiva gave you the money to buy food and rent a place. Rabbi Lezudel would underpay, or in his mind, I think he was paying enough, but he was, he didn't pay a lot. And he would, any good bacher, he would have learn with a weak, wealthy boy from Germany or America. There were German-American bacher taken in yeshiva. This was, irregardless of what madrega they were on, he felt, you have to, be married story there. They're not going to send these big Gaonim to the yeshiva. So German and American Bachim weren't there. There are quite a few that were alive. Some of them became Dola Olam, Zalberg, and so on. But he had it arranged that a very strong Bachim would learn with a weak one, and he would pay him. I believe, he didn't say why, but I believe part of it was to foster that sense of caring about that other kid also. There are Jews that need to learn. And this is a way in which he got that connection. So there are many ways to foster connection so that people understand the thirst for learning and the sense of what it means to teach another Yitira.
So I'm trying to phrase this in a delicate and a sensitive way, and it's something that you've touched on already, but in the model that the yeshiva or somebody in a kollel, when they meet somebody, so to speak, from the other shvatim, it's an opportunity for kiruv, so to speak. It's an opportunity to teach them Torah.
Right.
My concern with that is that the other, so to speak, becomes like a utilitarian, it's somebody who I can rope in. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little more about the appropriateness of like appreciating the space where they are right now, which is a dangerous thing and maybe contributes even to that dissonance, because you leave into the working world and you're 30 and you're working with other people in your law firm or in business, and they don't want a chavrusa, and they don't want to just sit and learn with you. And it's not a seed program where I got to go to Sydney, Australia, and you had to rope people in. So it's not necessary. You don't have the utilitarian, and I mean that in a spiritual way, like the ability to like be mashpia. It's a different framework. So how do you develop, or should you develop, an appreciation for like where they are? Because it's dangerous. There's like, you're kind of granting that there are Jews who are totally removed from a proper Jewish education and observance. But on the and you want to get them closer, obviously. But on the other hand, if getting them closer is always front and center, it can undermine like the dignity of where they are.
I think part of the broader, I guess, Musa education is to sensitize a person to other people. Usually, in all these situations, let's say like in seed programs, out of time kolim, you begin to appreciate other people. You begin to understand. Being close to people and having a modicum of menschlichkeit tends to make you understand and feel the other person and what's good about him, what's wonderful about him. I don't mean to advertise my experiment, I just put a book on Rus. It's an adaptation of Nachas Yosef. And in the back, I wrote a memoriam about my mother, Leah Shalom. I used to say why I wrote about it. And I wrote, I debated about writing it. You know, her father was a Chassidish, the kids all went, you know, mostly socialist, Bundist, so on. And I wrote that my two or three uncles that were left after the war. When I was young, I was kind of very, very taken aback. They were very vociferously, let's put it, non-from. But as I got older, I began to feel for them. I began to understand why they were so angry. They began to see they were very good in different ways. There were a lot of good points about it. And it was a process for me of growing up and being able to understand where and why they were, why they espouse what they espoused, and what's good and wonderful about them as people. It's complex. It takes, you know, again, younger people like to see things black or white. I always say when I was a teenager, somebody who spoke extreme and fiery and black or white was phenomenal. Somebody who hemmed and hawed and was even-handed was, either he had sold his neshama or didn't have good hashgachas. When I got older, I looked back at some of the things that I was turned on when I was younger, and I was kind of horrified. But this passage about my uncles, I asked people. It's very sensitive. I didn't, you know, and someone said, "Well, it'll help people understand other people." So I think it's part of Musa is to sensitize people to other people, understand where they're coming from. Understand what's good and beautiful and noble about different people. It's one of the big mistakes, I believe, in Kiruv type things. If you come in as a missionary and you know everything, and the other person knows nothing, and you're good, and the other person is only potentially good, and that's it, very, very tough. Then you're attacking the other person, and you're denying him value and self. I don't think that can work terribly well. But if you feel the other person, understand the other person, you have to understand where the other person's approach to Ruchnius is, and then see how that wends its way into Yiddishkeit. It takes appreciation from another person. It takes some level of understanding. It takes patience. But it's emes, I believe, and it works.
You wrote this sefer for Shevet Levi. What would you tell the proverbial Shevet Dun, somebody who didn't have a Jewish education, who grew up and maybe, or he had a Jewish education that they roll their eyes now. It's not for them. It didn't seep in. The passion didn't work for them. And now they find themselves totally on the outskirts, or maybe even regretting or being cynical about anything that seems more serious and more Torah-dic in a way. What's the book? What's the avenue? What are the strategies that you would tell somebody who finds themselves on the outskirts?
I think the first question a person needs to ask himself is, this Yiddishkeit that I'm talking about, would I give my life for it? You know, push came to shove. Whoever was standing with a gun, and most people would say probably yes, or it's something that they would definitely feel they needed to do, so whatever it is. And then ask yourself, it doesn't have to mean more than just something I happen to pick up, kind of customs or something. Most people down deep have a strong sense of like, if push came to shove, how much would you do to save Yiddishkeit? And then so why would I want to live a life that a deep part of me feels is so important, but it's not been translated? I need to be able to flesh out those values and rethink them in a way that this is a life meaningful enough to be willing to mosa nefesh. We read the stories about people who were mosa nefesh and gave their lives with tremendous admiration. And obviously there's something more to it than just kind of a nice custom, a nice this, nice that. There was a fellow who came to Eish HaTorah many years ago. This is, I taught in Eish HaTorah from 83 to 90. He was there, I guess, 85. Very sweet fellow, very intelligent. He had a traditional upbringing, possibly affiliated with the conservative movement. And he came to Shiri, he wanted to learn, but he did not want to become overly observant. I guess he wanted to be observant, but not like... And so Shabbos, he would slip away. He had cousins who lived someplace who were also kind of... I have no idea exactly how to identify themselves, but let's put it this way. They did everything with great moderation. And they were very afraid he would get too into it. So they would always tell him, don't become too religious, don't become too religious, don't become too religious. And finally, they once told him, wherever there are opinions about halacha, the most kulidic opinion is the opinion you should pick to follow. And something snapped, and he said, fellas, if you don't feel like doing it, why the heck are you doing it? For him, that was like a defining moment, and he became a real Ventura. He ended up learning the Mir for a few years, really very fine Ventura. The point was, it really, this constant advice finally brought home to him, what's the point of it? If it's not important, then what's the point of it? If, you know, Yiddishkeit is too demanding to be a nice custom. It either is genuine, or let's leave it at latkes and hamantash. But if it's meaningful enough, we're down deep, I feel tremendously deep in this, I need to flesh it out and to bring it out and to learn about it. I need to learn and understand it emotionally and intellectually.
Really beautiful, and I so appreciate it. I have three quick questions. One might be a drop longer that we usually wrap up. I really appreciate the time that the Rosh Hashiva took out to speak about this. It means a great deal. And I always ask, I'm just curious, all guests about their daily schedule. I'm always curious about when people go to sleep and when do they wake up?
I guess the older I get, the more I find that the early in the morning is the most what's the right word for it, quality time. For some reason, when you're young, so I try hard to get up as early as I can. It doesn't make a difference what time, and go to sleep as early as I can, because simply you get less phone calls early in the morning than you do late at night. And I find my head is much clearer. So it's been a shift in my life that's the direction I moved in.
In your article about sometimes Mashiach is not the solution, you mention you lament the fact that people do not study enough Jewish history. What books would you recommend for somebody who wants to learn more about Jewish history, but specifically to connect to the wider body of Jewish life, of Jewish people, of Jewish peoplehood?
It's complicated. It's something that's been a fantasy of mine. If only I could put out something or get somebody to put it out, I'm not going to be able to do it. I guess what you want is to understand what you're basing history on, which means documents, writings. You know, you see things where people just write and you say to yourself, that's amazing. Where's he coming from? You also want to have an overarching understanding of history. And to me, a typical secular historian is trying to find it, what's the context of issues that created the Torah and mentality of the people that live at a certain time, or not all Torah mentality, it's any history like that. I would like to understand it. I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it says, Dor L'Dor, every generation has a context and a mission. What were the challenges of each generation? And what was the Torah that came about and the direction that rose to meet it? Whether it was Hasidus, the Musa movement, and the contemporary Yeshiva movement, the Farah Baratzos, the Torah and Derech Eretz. I would like to understand the context of issues and problems and I unfortunately, the different things I read that I find have the facts and they, you know, sort of standing facts. Some of them put it together in certain ways. I haven't found it. I haven't done exhaustive research. Something that would give that context of understanding what challenges have we faced each generation? Where have we achieved something? And where do we still need to do something?
Is there a book that you have found, been surprised by, that like, wow, this really opened up pieces of Jewish history?
I found writings. There was somebody. He has a lot of different monographs. His name is Greenwald. He was a chashev rav. He came to America. He was Rav in Columbus. He wrote a Kol Ben Avelus, which was the popular Avelus book until it was, you know, overridden by modern stuff. He has a lot of wonderful monographs about different, you know, it was a very stormy tkufa that he lived in, and he wrote about other stormy tkufas. Everything he writes has a notation of where does he get it from, and he's writing, and he's a from Aralika person, so he's a Toradika person, but he's also writing in a way that's very, very open, candid, and you get a sense of what were the issues. And he wrote on a lot of different things. Now, some of the things are debatable. I could agree or disagree. That's neither here nor there. But I liked very much the style. A, he's coming with facts, and he feels the need to footnote everything. He's not telling you things that take my word for it. He's, you know, his annotations. Two, he's understanding everything with a Toradic view. And he also is open and frank about challenges and where we were less than stellar in meeting those challenges.
Final question, and you touched upon every generation having its own struggle. This has been a challenging year for the Jewish people. I'm curious of what the Rosh Yeshiva would say is the biggest challenge facing American Jewry, and what is the biggest opportunity right now?
I think, if I can give, again, we'll use an analogy. Life has become very comfortable for us physically, which means unless we're in the gym, we lose the ability to use a lot of our muscles because we take the car everywhere and we have the robot cleaning up everything and so on. So instead of using these machines to help us, I always use a muscle. If I walk up to 5 miles and I use a car for anything past 5 miles, the car has become an addition to me. If I use the car to go to my next door neighbor, then it's crippled me. The ability to have so much, so when it's so much shefa, But when we had challenges, Ruchnius built muscles. I remember when I came to the Mir, there was a big gemach that lent you a gemara for his man, and you brought it back and got back your deposit. Today, by us in the yeshiva, at the end of his man, we collect a dozen boxes of sperm, almost brand new, and nobody wants to claim them. If you have the name and you call it up, you call them up and you say, Yankali, you'll have your gemara, he says, give it to somebody. So nobody wants it because, you know, it's the most, somebody's made a business of it, actually. He charges you to take those gemaras. And I don't know what he does with it, but he does. So the fact that we have in the Mir Yeshiva in Europe, who had the magnificent library, you had to sign up 2 days in advance to look at a Rashba. So when you looked at a Rashba, you focused, you memorized it, you knew it. Today, it's become going to yeshiva. In my days, like, it was a challenge. I went out to stroll so that I wasn't disturbed. Today, Baruch Hashem, everyone goes automatically. So does it generate the same amount of juice? I went out to stroll. I never dreamt when I came, I would ever go there to stroll. And seeing the Kaisel for the first time in my life was an experience that's indescribable, as I'm sure anyone else. Today, we're... It's you know, you go on a fourth grade for their trip in the mid semester goes for Israel, because there's no challenge. Our ruchnistic muscles are not being tested and used, and we're flabby. And God forbid, when the car breaks, you can't even walk out because you can't walk 5 meters. So, to me, the blessing of having so much and so much opportunity is wonderful. But unless we build our muscles, and then chas v'shalom, the minute something happens, we're stuck. So we need to understand how to take the blessings of plenty that God gave us and not lose what challenges bring out in the person.
And in terms of opportunity, which you touched upon, what is the unique opportunities that you found that the Jewish world in 2020 has that previous generations did not?
One, the ability to take a few years and sit and learn and it not and be able to have parnasa afterwards. I mean, people today to sit and learn till they're 25. Is almost like it's not difficult to do at all. So you can sit and learn 7 years and still you go to law school afterwards, go to business, and you know, it's a little bit rough maybe, but you know, Baruch Hashem, we have enough comfort. But are those 7 years as meaningful as when every week you have to ask yourself, how are we going to make it to next week? It certainly is not as meaningful unless you make that effort. So we have the amount of money available so that we can take that amount of time, I think, is incredible. The fact that mitzvahs, let me give you another example. Somebody asked me about buying his son the best, you know, a blank check, the best pair of tefillin possible. Whatever it costs, person money is no object, it's not. I told him, chas v'shalom. He said, don't do that. I said, buy a good pair of tefillin. Let him someday learn the halachas of tefillin, understand what these hidurim are about. Let him save some money. Let him give some of his money. He'll appreciate it a lot more when he decides and says, you know, I want this and these hidurim because I've learned the halachas. I think it's important. And I'm willing to take $1,000, $2,000 of mine and add to it. But the idea that you can just run the credit card and get Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillin is we don't get the idea. This is true even secular ways. Giving your kid everything he wants is the worst thing you can do for him. It is the worst thing. Earning his way. And so I'm not talking about the stereotype of, you know, a Charles Dickens novel where you stand with a pet, you know, and you'll say, okay, if you didn't hold a garden this morning, you ain't getting breakfast. There's a big difference between that and saying, oh, Tati, you want an iPad? Okay, the newest model is $1,000. You know, bring two of them just to make sure that you have one. You're not helping anyone. You're not doing anything. Earning things is the greatest satisfaction of life. So making things, understanding there are things you can't have. That's the way life is. understanding the things you have to work harder, understanding you have to make choices. Those are core values across the board. They certainly are very important in the autistic world. That a child should feel he needed to make a choice and some sort of sacrifice. If you're learning in yeshiva, you're not coming home every Monday, Thursday, whatever it is. There'll be things you'll miss. And it's hard, but that makes you choose. And I think rethinking, understanding, it's not just because there's no money, but because it's chinuch. And I think that's going to be a very, very big fact in deciding how our ruchnistic muscles are developed.
Thank you so much. It really, the amount of time that you gave and the direction, the guidance, it means a great deal. I can't thank you enough for sharing your time with us. And Amir Tashem, we should get to meet once again in person when it's healthy, good, safe.
Yes, Hashem.
Thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of 1840 with our interview with Rev Aaron Lopiansky. I hope you found it as enjoyable as me. I think for me, the analogy that I love the most is when he described those maps that are in a classroom, so to speak, that are always hard to read. And it made me think about what does your map, so to speak, look like of the Jewish community? There used to be this old New Yorker cartoon that had a road stretching out, and before the road was kind of just, you know, New York, and as you stretch farther out, like, it was just less and less. You just see, you know, these sprawling states and the world, and then eventually Russia. And I think different people have maps that look like that of the Jewish community. It's been satirized in many places, and I think that notion and that consideration of what your Jewish map looks like is definitely something worth thinking about. So I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. It wouldn't be a Jewish podcast without a little bit of schnarring. So if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review. Tell your friends about it. It really helps us reach new listeners and continue putting out great content. If you'd like to learn more about this topic or some of the other great topics that we've covered, be sure to check out 1840.org. That's the number 18 followed by the word 40, FORTY.org. You'll find videos, articles, recommended readings, each on our monthly topics. Thank you so much for listening.